Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is Tuesday, July 27th, 2004. Today's session number is DYL 2004-07. Today's speaker is Laurel Dykstra. The lesson for today is Jubilee and Justice, Jubilee Movements in History. Let's listen in.
Last May, and I'm here for 2 weeks now. I did a class last week from my book on Exodus, which is called Set Them Free, The Other Side of Exodus, available in the bookstore. You know, how should we without one? So that was a lot about looking at the story of Exodus, but reading it from a first world perspective, and what is it like to be people who live in an empire of global capitalism? How is that similar or not similar to the situation of Egypt in that story? So that's what that's about. This week I am doing a class on Jubilee and also helping to animate the big Jubilee celebration on Thursday, and I'm kind of working hard on the pageant, so I got a little bit of pink under my nails right now. I think what we'll do is we'll go around, and I'm viewing everybody that I encounter from this point on as sort of recruits for the pageant. And so what we'll do is we'll go around and we'll just say our names, and then we'll get up and do some of the motions that the kids have been doing to talk about Jubilee. So how about each person say their name, and this is helping me to remember names, so maybe it'll help you too. As a person says their name, we all say it back. Maybe that'll just cement it in. So I'm Laurel.
Asa.
Hanifa. Wow, I'm amazed at those names.
Mary.
Mary.
Karen.
Karen.
Betsy.
Amy. Selena.
Amy. Selena.
Oh, Mary.
Mary.
Barry.
Barry. Barry. Barry. Beth. Well, welcome everybody. I wonder if folks who know or folks who were here last time we met, could we do sort of a speedy review, and I'm not forgetting about the motions, we'll come to them, in case you were thinking you were getting away with still staying in your chairs. Sort of a speedy review of the biblical Jubilee from Hebrew Bible and from the Christian Testament. What is Jubilee?
Forgiveness of debts.
Forgiveness of debts.
No slaves.
Pardon me?
And of slaves.
Release of slaves.
Mm-hmm. Redistribute the land.
Redistribute the land. And sort of redistributing wealth in the form of land. Some of the basic principles, that slaves were released, that the land rested, that people rested, that animals that worked the land rested, that fields lay fallow, that wealth was redistributed in the terms of both debt cancellation and in terms of, you know, land being wealth. Land was returned to, the only way that land could change hands was through debt foreclosure. And so land returned to the people who had it previously.
Did they actually do this?
That was a question from the last class. And we don't know. And there's a hard, you know, it's something that there's not going to be kind of hard archaeological evidence for. And so so we need to evaluate it in other ways. It seems like certainly sort of at the minimum, you know, a lot of Sabbath practice was clearly practiced. Mm-hmm. And that there were some reform movements that really called for reintroduction of Jubilee. So it seems like some things sometimes, and you know, kind of depending on what those things were. One of the things about the Bible is that we really, for the most part, we don't know whether it's descriptive or whether it's prescriptive. We don't know whether, whether wives obey your husbands is what people were doing or what somebody thought was a good idea. So we can't tell whether it describes the reality of the time or what somebody wanted the reality to be. What about what happened with Christianity, and how did Jesus and then subsequently Christianity and Jesus' movement after him expand the New Belief program? Anyone? Okay, a couple of elements that were really sort of critical to what Jesus was about and what he did during his life, which is sort of the neglected part of Jesus' life, focus on his death and not so much on his life, was that he ate with sinners and outcasts, that he practiced a kind of open table commensality, that this notion of God's abundance and of redistribution was really concretely sort of exemplified and lived out around food. That there were stories about feeding huge groups of people. There were stories about eating at the houses of all different kinds of people. And that, so food and having enough food and sharing food with all kinds of people were an expansion of the Jubilee. And coinciding with that, the idea of community. Curiously, Jesus doesn't have a lot to say about family, despite what a lot of people want to say about family values. And most of what Jesus has to say about families isn't good, you know, isn't laudatory. But what is sort of put forward and spoken about and also lived is an example of community. So community rather than the Levitical law, which was really kind of focused on narrowly on tribe and family, is more expansive, that we share wealth amongst all of us, that there's a bigger community that sort of widens out. And also that some of these practices of, you know, of wealth sharing, of eating together aren't possible outside of community. You can't do it in a nuclear family, you can't do it in the extended patriarchal top-down family, but there needs to be another model. So family, eating, and another big thing is health and bodies. In the sort of inaugural speech of the Luke, where Jesus kind of starts out his ministry reading from the passage from Isaiah, where Isaiah talks about what does Jubilee look like. There's proclaiming sight to the blind and liberty to the captives. And so one of the things that it expands the notion of who's a slave as well. It's not just slaves, but prisoners. So that's a pretty radical concept. And additionally, that that health and healing and bodies and restoring people to community who were socially disabled because of the purity laws around their kind of bodies was also a part of sort of that expansion of Jubilee. So we've got all of the kind of the economic principles of sharing the wealth and freeing the slaves and renewing the earth. And those are kind of the three that are going to be the big principles of our celebration. And then expanded beyond that in the early church and through kind of the work and teachings of Jesus to include food, community, and one third one, and bodies, and health. So as you can see, it's sort of an expanded understanding of what God's abundance means, what it means that there's enough for people. And so, in case you thought I forgot, we are going to get up, and we're going to do some of the movements that are going to be part of the Jubilee pageant that various folks working with us on the stage have come up with. So for the various principles, it's getting ready for Thursday. We're going to do sharing the wealth right from the pockets and renewing the earth and freeing the slaves. And so sort of, so this becomes a call and response. And in between, I'll call out the one and we'll do the motion. And then you can all respond, Jubilee. And this will be really good practice. So I call out, share the wealth. And you say,
Jubilee.
Share the wealth. motions together now. So, and I'm reading this from the page too. And maybe when we do Jubilee, we can do that.
Yeah.
Okay? So, share the wealth.
Jubilee.
Free the slaves.
Jubilee.
Renew the earth.
Jubilee.
Oh, yeah.
Do we do all the motions or just
pardon
the Jubilee
motion? What do you think?
Oh, I don't know.
Can you get them all in?
I don't know.
That seems like might be more than we can manage. Okay, let's try it one more time and see if we can get the words and the motions.
That would be good.
So, share the wealth.
Jubilee.
Free the slaves.
Jubilee.
Renew the earth.
Jubilee.
No.
But I think the sequencing could be confusing. I mean, when to do the actions if people don't know what you're going to say.
We'll practice some more.
But that's a good point.
All right. Yeah, look, the glitches are coming out. So this is good. These are principles of Jubilee. And it's something that developed Jesus's and Luke's interpretation of kind of Jesus's inaugural speech are developments that come from Isaiah, who developed the older tribal law. And we don't really know how old this notion of Sabbath and Jubilee is. We know that it was important to folks in the 6th century, kind of the priestly caste, but we don't know how important it was how long before. So the stuff like the question, you know, was it practiced, who practiced it, comes up. But what we do know is that it developed over time. And what we're going to do is kind of a fun thing, is we're going to look at a play that some folks, and it was collectively written by a bunch of different people, and it kind of traces Jubilee movements through history, and it kind of just picks up a few threads and moves here and there. We're going to look at some stuff mostly starting in the 1600s. So I need 5 people who will be readers, and probably, as mostly it traces kind of women's stories, and mostly this cast has women, that might be a good idea for some of those folks to volunteer. And there's 5 players, so we'll just start sort of reading along that way. Who would love to read? Is it Beth?
Is that right?
Yes.
All right.
2 more players. And 1 more. Yay. Okay, and what we'll do is, I think people can hear you from your seats, and so we'll just read through. It's only about 4 pages long, and it gets some of the ideas and principles. It's a little fun. Ignore the stage directions. We won't burst into song where it says burst into song, but we'll get some of the stuff, but you can, you know, sort of listen while you're reading and while you're listening, just listen.
So,
who is who? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. How about that?
1, 2, 5.
1, 2, you're
2.
Oh,
sorry,
I was, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Okay.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Sorry.
You got a little dramatic there.
No, because I thought that Mary in the back, I had given her one. I was mistaken. And a lot of this is reasonably well researched. It comes from sort of historical pamphlets at the time and stuff. So this is a read aloud.
And this is 1600?
Yes. Yeah. And there's sort of narration. Mm-hmm. There might be a narrator there, or it might just say players 1 through 5. Is there anything that says narrator?
Looks like players.
Okay, good.
Okay, I guess player 2 starts.
The idea of Jubilee itself went through various corruptions. In the Middle Ages, the Catholic popes had jubilees every 50 years. The jubilee was used to collect special indulgences. In other words, people paid to be released from spiritual debt and the slavery of sin. However, in England, to honor the 50-year reigns of Henry III in 1265 and Edward III in 1377, prisoners and debtors were released, but with no economic reform.
The values of Jubilee reappeared a few centuries later, in the 1600s, as part of the leveler and digger movements, which protested the enclosures, the fencing in of the commons, by wealthy landowners.
The years 1645 to 1653 were a tumultuous time known as the English Revolution. Enclosures of the common lands, evictions of tenants from their holdings, and a general economic dislocation contributed to increasing numbers of masterless men in the world. They were now wanderers through necessity, forest squatters, itinerant craftspeople, unemployed women and men, strolling players, jugglers, peddlers. The cost of living was high and poverty was widespread. Let's listen to Catherine Chidley, a woman from this time.
Oh, that the cravings of our stomachs could be heard by the parliament and city. Oh, that tears of our poor famished babes were bottled. Oh, that the tender mother's cries for bread to feed them were engraven in brass. Oh, you members of parliament and rich men of the city that are at ease and drink wine in bowls and stretch yourselves on beds of down, you that grind our faces and flay off our skins, is there none to pity? O parliament, men and soldiers, necessity dissolves all laws and government, and hunger will break through stone walls. Tender mothers will sooner devour you than the fruit of their own womb.
This was fertile ground for radical ideas of economic and political freedom. The Bible was now being printed and was affordable for the peasants and laboring classes, with even women being printers and booksellers. A radical interpretation of that book began to emerge. There is no ground in nature or scripture why one person should have, is that pounds? 1,000 pounds per annum, another not 1 pound. After all, when Adam delved and Eve span, who then was the gentleman? We must teach that all are alike and that there is no difference between masters and servants. Away. Hostility toward the clergy was widespread because the church demanded unfair taxes.
I do not give a pin nor a fart for my lord's grace of Canterbury, and hope I should live to see him hanged.
The said gentleman was indeed hanged 11 years later.
Those women that you knew of?
Mary Carey.
Catherine Chidley.
Anna Trapnell.
Mary Fisher.
Rachel Speck and many others made their voices heard in different ways.
We petitioned against enclosure of the commons and the clearing of the fens and forest. We heckled statesmen, roughed up mayors, tossed chairs in church, bawled abuse at ministers. We were whipped, stalked, and carted off to prison.
We denounced swindling.
We denounced profiteering.
We denounced oppression of dissidents.
And the desperate hunger of the poor.
We were prepared to forfeit freedom, property, health, and even life for such causes.
The poorest person hath as true a title and just right to the land as the richest. True freedom lies in the free enjoyment of the earth.
Our mission is to raise the servant against the master, the tenant against the landlord, the buyer against the seller, the borrower against the lender, the poor against the rich.
Pleading for property and single interest divides the people of the land and the whole world into parties, and it's the cause of all wars and bloodshed and contention everywhere.
But once the earth becomes a common treasury again, as it must, then this enmity of all lands will cease, and none shall dare to seek dominion over others, neither shall any dare to kill another, nor desire more of the earth than another.
Freedom is in the people who will turn the world upside down. Therefore, no wonder they have enemies.
Many of the groups, the Levelers, the Quakers, the Fifth Monarchists, and Separatists, offered religious and political solutions. But it was the Diggers, also called the True Levelers, who espoused economic solutions. Gerard Winston Lee was their spokesperson. The Diggers demanded the lords of the manor stop cutting the forests on the commons and called for the abolition of prisons and the confiscation of church and royalist land, which was to be added to the Commonwealth Land Fund and turned over to the poor. Collective action in manuring the commons was seen as a religious act by the Diggers.
True religion is to let everyone quietly have earth to manure. 'Twas us that planted the carrots, parsnips, and beans, crops which helped keep the cattle alive in order to fertilize the land.
The Diggers colony on St. George's Hill in 1649 was the first of many Digger communities on common land. It lasted less than a year, but the Digger vision lived on. We invite you to stand and join us in singing.
Okay. You can fast forward through
that. Fast forward to number five.
Okay. History sees Jubilee reappear in English radicalism of the 18th and 19th centuries. There has been a large shift in the British textile industry. Women who had worked at home as glove makers, button sewers, weavers, and tailors were gradually being faced with the competition of the new mechanized factories. A new merchant class had emerged, which was hiring unskilled labor to undercut the home crafts. Women and children were hired to work in the factories and the coal mines at starvation wages. Women were very much a part of the working class resistance to these conditions. We now go to the wool manufacturing township of Elland, Yorkshire. The year is 1839. Elizabeth Hanson has just returned from a meeting of the Elland Female Chartist Association.
This is a dirty trick on whoever randomly drew this number, because you now have like about a page to read. So if folks want, we can divide that up.
And who is it? Is it still five?
It's Elizabeth.
It's Elizabeth.
Probably
it's
you.
Elizabeth.
It's you.
Well, how about if I read another paragraph or two? And,
sure. Okay. Yeah, that's
the one. Because otherwise, it looks like I go on.
Yeah. The whole page?
Yeah.
This was the monologue part of the performance.
Oh, I'm so tired. My eyes aren't as good as they used to be, and my back aches from working on the loom. And little Francis was up all last night. But what a meeting. We have to get this township ready for August 12th. I just had to go to the meeting because I knew there would be a big debate about the grand national holiday, our first general strike. But wait, do you know what's happening in Elland? This town, we were all working and doing pretty well a while back, but then those new power looms came in. Abraham had to go off and work in a factory, so has my sister Jenny. But now we have less money. But we have less money now. Factory pays less. She only brings in 7 shillings a week. So with 6 mouths to feed, we had to send my son Thomas to work in the mines. And he's only 11. So it makes sense.
'Tis a cruel system that forces a family apart, that forces women and children to work because the factory owners can pay them less. Do you know that they say 1/3 of the workers in the Yorkshire coal mines are women and children? Down there with the solitary candle, lying out full length in the cold and damp, chipping away with a small pick to get a little piece of coal out of the sea. In Bradford, where Ellie Jane and her husband have gone to find work, half the workers in the factories are women and children. 6, 7, 8, 9 years of age. And you know why they're there? It's because of that wretched poor law. There's no more relief. You either work for starvation wages in the mines or factories, or you are sent to the workhouse and work for no wages at all. Because my husband's earnings cannot support the family, I have been compelled to leave the home neglected, and with my infant children, work at soul and body degrading toil on the power loom.
Elizabeth Hanson and other Elland women got together and formed the Elland Female Anti-Poor Law Association. The women came to meetings in droves, hundreds even, to discuss these laws against the poor and the general inequality in society. There was organizing and actions going on all over the country. Women started Chartist schools, organized petitions, marched, and resisted the imposition of the poor laws. In places like Lanlows and Halifax, women pelted troops and police with bricks and stones when they tried to imprison their male comrades.
What's happening now, you ask? We're planning for August 12th, the beginning of the grand national holiday. It will be a general strike where all working people can finally stop work and have a rest for a month. This month will be a festival for us, and we know such a festival is approved by God. Thomas Ben Gough says it was an established custom among the ancient Hebrews called the Jubilee. A holiday means a holy day, and ours is to be the most holy. Our holy day is to establish plenty, to abolish want, and to render all equal. We women of Ellen, have taken to the idea of a holiday. We can stop working in the mines and factories, and so can our kids. Well, everybody didn't agree at the meeting. There is only 1 week left, and I have to go to bed now. But you decide if you'll join us next week when we start our Jubilee month of rest, our grand national holiday.
By the mid-19th century, the term Jubilee had lost its radical edge. It became associated with patriotism. By the time of Queen Victoria's Jubilee anniversary, its political meaning had been lost. But something else was happening with Jubilee across the Atlantic. It was a theme in the movement for slave emancipation in North America and in farmers organizing in the United States.
The ultimate development of the land grabbing of early industrial capitalism was a campaign of genocide against the first people by European colonizers. On the West Coast, potlatch tradition, like Jubilee, a means of redistributing wealth, was outlawed because it fundamentally challenged capitalism. To work one's native land to provide the wealth for the exploding European and American economies, women and men from Africa were forced into slavery. Continents of people were displaced, enslaved, and massacred. For 350 years, slavery flourished in the Caribbean. For 242 years in the United States, creating unspeakable conditions of suffering and terror for women, children, and men.
In this period, spirituals became the collective music of the slaves, a way to express their longing for freedom. Slave women had a central role as community leaders of sacred songs and secret worship. Spirituals carried codes of resistance and provided a way of liberating the spirit from the psychological bonds of oppression. The term Jubilee became synonymous with freedom and was found in many of the spirituals as a word for the day of liberation here on earth, when all would be free. Many of these spirituals later became the basis for union songs.
While Jubilee kept alive the vision of freedom for the slaves, some were able to escape. The road to freedom took place on the legendary Underground Railroad, a series of secret routes through the northern states and into Canada. One of the most famous underground conductors was Harriet Tubman. Born a slave in Maryland about 1823, she fled slavery in 1849 and moved to St. Catharines, Ontario in 1851. She was personally responsible for freeing over 300 slaves during 19 separate trips to the South and was called Black Moses. She later returned to the U.S. during the Civil War as a scout, nurse, and spy with the Union Army. She sang spirituals as she passed through towns, announcing her intention to escort her fellow slaves northward without her message being heard by white slaveholders.
So what did folks notice? What did folks think? It was a little long in the middle there, but kind of conveyed some of the personal stories and the way that Jubilee got picked up in a couple of different times and used for.
Do we know if this group in England was going to try to have a month? Do we know if they were successful?
I know that there was a sort of a short national, general strike. I don't know how long it lasted. So yeah, I think the idea of what a great holiday is a really it's kind of a beautiful interpretation of Jubilee.
Mm-hmm. What occurred to me was a notable absence of any church leadership in any of these movements.
Yeah, it starts out with how the church in Rome picked up the notion of Jubilee and had 50-year Jubilee celebrations that involved like extra indulgences. So it was a concentrating of wealth with the church, and then very much a lack of church leadership.
Somewhere there was a comment about, well, once we get everybody even and redistribute the land, then nobody will want more than their share. And I thought, that was really optimistic of them.
Some of those, that's interesting. A lot of the quotes are taken from pamphlets from the time, and some of them are authored and some of them are anonymous. And it was known that that the printing industry was one of the areas where women had, were headed families, had type of industry. So we assume that some of those are sort of women's pamphlets. Some of them are specifically quoted to people. So somewhere the language is kind of stilted, that's because it's old, which is kind of neat to sort of hear these women's voices through time.
I thought it was interesting that just following it through a time period and how it changed, to meet whatever of that time.
The elements of land are there, the elements of leveling. I love the pamphlet about the manuring the common.
What were the diggers?
The diggers were a group. There's a lovely song, which I don't think I dare to sing aloud, but there are a variety of people who have recordings of it. Billy Bragg is one of them. In 1649, I'm not sure exactly when the year of the enclosures law happened, but it used to be that people had individual land holdings and then there were commons. And the commons were where everyone could graze their cattle and could do some farming. And they were lands that were held in the commons. And there was a law in the 1600s in Britain that lords enclosed the commons and took that over. And then were able to throw people off of it, rent it. Mostly what they did was they kicked off the peasants who lived there and grazed sheep. And the levelers, the new levelers, and the diggers, and some of the Chartists and the fifth somethings were all groups that did different kinds of resistance to that. And Gerard Wing Stanley was the spokesperson for the diggers. And he writes beautifully about how we are free and that we live on this land and we don't need masters and we don't need servants and we won't live by the sword and that, and so what they did was they communally farmed the commons and took that back and that particular community lasted less than a year, that they sort of sprung up and disappeared and they were repressed pretty harshly. So that's who the diggers were. And further to them, sort of in San Francisco in the 1960s, there were some folks who were, if you want to speak more.
Well,
to
no, them, I just remember the diggers in San Francisco.
Yeah.
What's the name of a band that, banjo player?
The Weavers?
Was it Weavers? Wasn't there also the diggers? Wasn't that another?
But there were, I don't remember the diggers specifically, but they were part of a whole movement that was giving away free food, and some people were gleaning, and they brought up big festivals and hand out food. And,
so similar to stuff that Food Not Bombs does now, Seeds of Peace, that's kind of similar stuff. Mm-hmm. And they were kind of a bunch of hippies in the Bay Area that were living communally and sort of looking at some of these principles, and a number of those folks are were founding members of various Catholic worker communities that are still going on in the Bay Area. So they're sort of continuing of those notions.
I'm kind of curious about the Jubilee model that you mentioned. If every 7 years the land, which could only be taken from somebody by debt, was returned to its original owner. Every 7 years, it would just go back to another form of individual ownership, and the people that you can't have, not to have.
I think the land, there's a variety of cycles on which everything happens. So that every 7 years,
I think that the land was every 50.
Every 40 or 70.
Once in a generation.
It didn't go into common holding.
It didn't go into common holding. And in fact, the original owners that are spoken of are actually sort of the 12, the various sons of the 12 tribes, the 12 sons of Jacob that came, or yeah, the 12 sons of Jacob, including Joseph, who came into the promised land, you know, who arrived in the promised land and annihilated the inhabitants and took the land that was there. And so there are definitely some problems and some issues with these original owners. And interestingly, one of the reasons that the land stuff kind of fades out and there's more kind of economic stuff and food stuff is because people didn't have land anymore by the time of Jesus. And so there wasn't that Israel didn't have land. So that there was sort of a concentration in cities and that with sort of layers of different empires or different first world nations under which they were subject, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Romans, there was that people didn't have land holdings anymore, and so that wasn't a major source of wealth.
The church wasn't mentioned in this, but one good thing that some churches took a lead in was the Jubilee debt forgiveness.
Yeah,
that was really powered on by the churches. What about 3 or 4 years ago?
Yeah, people kind of took advantage of the millennium.
Yeah.
Look, that's a number that's got, you know, that's divisible by 50.
Yeah.
Let's focus on the issue of international debt. Yeah. And churches really did take leadership in that. And had some moderate accomplishments there. There were sort of big awareness. Those campaigns are still continuing. Most of the world's most heavily indebted countries have, paid off their loans and are now paying over and over the interest on those loans. To the extent that, despite the fact that there's enormous, sort of poverty relief that goes to those countries from the West, there's still a net transfer of money coming out of those countries through debt payment. So that the poorest countries of the world are paying the most wealthy countries of the world through the for-profit institutions of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. And so some of the stuff, like around the World Trade Organization demonstrations in Seattle, that there was a way that that church folks were able to plug in with other kinds of activists and work side by side and respectfully with them, that was really very positive. And there's continuing. I think that the British campaigns are sort of better organized and more continuing. There's some folks in DC who are still, I think under the name of Jubilee 2000, still continuing to do debt relief work and organizing. And that is an area where churches have really taken some leadership. So that's kind of neat. It's interesting that, the Jubilee is clearly overt in the debt relief stuff that in modern churches, and that it was much more subtle in the Industrial Revolution, when there were sort of a few places where they were like, yes, we're going to have a Jubilee, and the rest was sort of the inherent dignity of people in poverty and the issues that they were faced with. Again, where it was really overt was in the antebellum South, in the anti-slavery resistance of enslaved peoples. That there was pretty, in some, reasonably subtle, reasonably obscure texts, they were very clearly able to sort of exegete out what was important in those and have a whole kind of theology,
music of liberation and understanding of what Jubilee meant for them out of their situation of slavery. That was very, very clear and very, very together. Yeah, what else? We haven't talked a lot about the slavery stuff.
What happened to the release? Like, did it become citizens or?
Which slaves?
Oh, in Jubilee.
In the Levitical stuff, the only operating kind of slavery between the people of Israel was debt slavery. There are statutes about you can't buy one another. But if in the event of you're falling into debt, you put up your land for foreclosure and you can lose your land that way, but the land belongs to God, was fundamental understanding. And so if we keep that as our root, that the land belongs to God, rather than, the land belongs to the son of 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 Reuben, who was the son of Jacob, then you've got a little more to work with. So they returned to their status as citizens, as free. And there are all kinds of rules. We're going to talk a little bit more on Friday about, what's missing. Some of the readings that we did from Leviticus, the Jubilee statutes take up pages and pages and pages. And so a little bit for clarity and a little bit for sort of editing for a liberative message, I've been handing out a sort of edited version, or at least with some bits removed. And we're going to look at, what are the missing bits? And some of the missing bits are, these really good rules, they apply to Israel. They apply to Israelites. They don't include everybody. And so that the more that these ideals are expanded and the more that they're taken on and espoused by people who are living in a situation of poverty, a situation of oppression, a situation of, more and more in the world, debt slavery is still functioning and existing and kind of finding new ways to be exploited in the global economy that are really similar and really different to the sort of biblical slavery and chattel slavery of history.
That slavery of whole nations, like third world nations, mm-hmm. and them having to go and sort of slave like things to satisfy the debt that they can't go satisfy.
Yeah, there's sort of two things going on. There is this the sort of slave-like conditions of nations, and there's also, according to a pretty conservative estimate, like 27 million people living in slavery today. Which is actually, I think, the subject for, our next class tomorrow at 5:45. We're going to talk about prostitution and slavery and how sort of the lives of modern slaves are related to our lives and what Jubilee could mean for them.
I was thinking about, through this whole thing, the ideas of Jubilee and placing in the current context of the anti-colonialism movement and just at how related they are and how I don't usually come at it from a Christian perspective or from a biblical perspective, and they're very similar.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of ways that, the history of churches not taking leadership means that we've got a lot of credibility to build up with people who've been dealing with these issues in other ways for a long time. So there's like I said, that folks were able to work really good, really well together in WTO, Purvis, and some other situations, and there's still a lot of mistrust there. And
a lot of, you know, arguing about what's the right way to do the right thing, mm-hmm. which is pretty counterproductive. Interestingly, like there's a big British debt cancellation campaign that has church leadership, but Britain is very much, you know, less churched than the United States. So that's an interesting sort of.
And does Bonham have something to do with that, or is that more the UN?
Oh, you know, we have something to do with that. I don't know what the UN involvement is.
Yeah. That's interesting. I mean, you can read all these texts and Exodus and the Gospels and things. I mean, and as you talked about last week a little bit, some of it seems real contradictory. I mean, God can seem real. But it does seem like, and maybe I'm reading the Bible through my own eyes, but it seems like the whole message is always equality, justice, I mean, of the Old and New Testaments. So
it's certainly a strong stream.
One of the strongest.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it's not the only stream, but it's one a very strong stream.
I noticed when I was, sorry.
Oh, go ahead. Well, you do wonder, and you know, I can look at my own life and say, why doesn't the church stand up and, you know, if that's what we're being called to do. So that's always a question for me, what is Christ really calling us? If we're followers of Christ, what are we really called to do? And like you were talking about, you can read the Bible through so many different streams, but that's always one that I've seen as the strongest. It's a minority.
I was thinking about the aspects of Jubilee and thinking about sort of our celebration on Thursday, and that we address sort of the least well the issue of slavery. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that despite the fact that slavery exists worldwide, it's not something that a lot of people know about, it's not something that a lot of people talk about, and that getting that information out and sort of raising awareness around that and campaigns that are working on those issues seem to me to be a really important thing to be able to do. I brought a book by Kevin Bales. It's called Disposable People, The New Slavery in the Global Economy. It's an excellent, excellent book. The bookstore got some and sold out basically just instantly. Because they didn't get a lot, which is kind of disappointing. A new edition is coming out fairly soon. So what I would do is, like, if you do a search now, they'll say, the new edition is available. But when you say, okay, click buy that for me, it won't. So it's not quite available. But if you kind of hold your breath for a month or so, B-A-L-E-S, Disposable People. Very, very worthwhile book.
So what are the main countries with the most slavery?
Some of the main countries are Brazil, Pakistan, India, Thailand, Mauritania. Those are some off the top of my head. So, but another thing that is that you know, wealthy industrialized nations also have an kind of collude in slavery. That, you know, certainly in major cities all around the world, in, you know, in New York, in Seattle, in Los Angeles, there are household slaves. There are people who have been brought from other countries who are serving a family, who are, you know, essentially owned by that family, who receive no pay for the work that they do. Numbering in the thousands in any large city, maybe the tens of thousands. And then there's the issue of, you know, folks who are brought from various countries as either sort of enslaved sex workers or enslaved, sometimes agricultural workers, and very often garment industry. So all of those. So it's definitely there's countries. Also there's companies and individuals.
With the global market, I mean, slaves are really moved like huge spanses. I mean, they collect a lot of people in Eastern Europe and former Soviet Union, and basically steal them and make them sex slaves in military bases all over the world, in America, in all countries. You know, it's not really geographic like our food sources, most things anymore.
Yeah, it's no longer a buying local issue.
So are the laws against slavery kind of worse, or?
It varies country to country. In the United States, you can bring your household servants when you immigrate to this country.
Mm-hmm.
What you need to provide is a document which you can write yourself saying that you employ this person.
But if you bring them by force and don't pay them, that would be slavery.
Somebody finds out.
Crime.
Yes.
But if they're staying because they have no other, they have no skills to go outside of their home and find a job.
If you keep their passport. Yeah.
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 Right.
If you don't let them leave the building, there's around household slaves, there's sort of restrictions like that. Frequently, folks who are more industrial slaves are, you know, up in compounds, are in an apartment complex that's a closed complex. You can see, you know, where I live in Vancouver, sort of the neighborhood where I live to the neighborhood where I like to buy my groceries, there was sort of a industrial kind of garment district. And you could see where, you know, which buildings probably had sweatshops, because they were clearly used for industry. The top floors were, the windows were all blacked out, mm-hmm. and there would be all sort of fabric waste outside the buildings, a lot of Asian women working there, and everything, like you couldn't knock on the door and go in ever, it was all very dark. And those are often situations of debt slavery, where a person is, you know, paying off their passage in perpetuity.
Hmm. So are stories looking the other way?
Generally, what happens is that the perpetrators, the folks who brought the people here, pay a fine.
Mm-hmm.
That's not enough.
They can afford. Doesn't free the person that the people are being slaved?
No, they're sent home.
They're sent home.
They're sent back to the
country.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a worse punishment for them.
Yeah.
You know, so they receive the most harsh penalty. Because, you know, because they're not sent to their family. You know, they're sent to the capital city. Yeah, so the harshest punishment goes to the workers, the people who are enslaved, and the the monetary punishments are mostly pretty affordable.
Yeah.
You know, there are a few cases of people who are sort of notorious repeat offenders that are known about, which means that there are many, 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 many more who are, you know, you just sort of finance that into your to what it's going to cost, what you're paying to find something.
Well, company towns in the mines and things used to be a form of slavery,
yeah.
and that you could never make enough money to pay off your rent and food, so.
Mining is a sort of particularly notorious industry.
It
still.
Is.
Yeah.
And in Africa,
in
Africa, Ladysmith Black Mambazo sings about, you know, what's happened with their lives. They never get to go home. They live in dormitories. They get paid very little. It was mine.
So we're sort of moving ahead to the last thing. But that's good. That means they're in the right order.
Yeah.
Yeah, so basically the point for today was that the idea of Jubilee really has moved to different times and been adopted as the need arises in different situations and in different cultures.
So how was communist impulse related to this? certainly it seems like...
What is the communist impulse?
Well, the idealistic idea that, that everybody owns everything. That nobody owns everything. The state owns everything and you are the state. And that is...
Well, there's not a notion of the state, certainly, in the political codes and the political law.
Because it seems like, I mean, it certainly wasn't the solution, but it seems like some of it came from the same motives, which was to get rid of these wealthy people that were basically controlling and impoverishing their ability and sort of make everybody...
Redistribute the wealth.
Yeah, and make people equal and employ them according to their abilities, and of course it probably corrupted them. It's certainly not a religious movement or impulse.
That's pretty anti-religious.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I think the economic level, there are certainly parallels. And I think sort of the community, the care of bodies, some aspects of the justice stuff, there are less parallels. Okay, let's do names one more time and see if that helps us remember. Laurel.
Asa.
Asa.
Hanifa.
Hanifa.
Mary.
Mary.
Karen.
Betsy.
Betsy.
Amy.
Mary.
Bear.
Bear.
Beth.
Beth. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you
for coming.
Thank you
for taking part. And tomorrow's class is at 5:45. We're going to talk about prostitution and slavery. And there's a work party for stuff on the Jubilee pageant that's happening after Vespers on the BC stage, which we would love to have folks come to.
Tonight.
And we're a little behind where we'd like to be. Also tomorrow morning from 9 to noon. So. Come on down, have a swell time. Don't forget to pick up your copy of my book, that you will. Lovely Golden Village Bookstore.